All films begin pretty much in the same place, the imagination. After that, where your imagination takes you and where your idea ends up is anyone's guess. Yet for all those possibilities, there is but one certainty. Somewhere along the way, there is always, always, always a typewriter. Or, to be more contemporary, a keyboard. Yet, even though everyone knows that a good script is the bedrock for a good movie, it is curious that in cinema, the writer and the entire writing process are treated so, so badly. So badly, in fact, you'll be tempted to think that a film is less the imagination of the writer and more the sadistic fantasies of tyrannical directors and vengeful producers who relegate the writers to, well, think of what miseries are heaped upon Barton Fink.
You think you're the only writer that can give me that Barton Fink feeling? I got 20 writers under contract I can ask for a Fink-type thing from!
Then again, writers don't seem to have a very high regard for themselves either. Think of the agonies Charlie Kaufman puts himself through in Adaptation.
To write about a flower, to dramatize a flower, I have to show the flower's arc. And the flower's arc stretches back to the beginning of life. How did this flower get here? What was its journey?
But at least those writers were still alive at the end. In Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard, Joe Gillis is shot dead by faded movie star Norma Desmond.
It's dawn now, and they must have photographed me 1,000 times. Then they got a couple of pruning hooks from the garden and fished me out, ever so gently.
Or what about Robert Altman's The Player, where studio executive Griffin Mill attacks and drowns another struggling screenwriter, David Kahane.
Just stop all the postcard shit.
I don't write postcards! I write scripts!
We're both wrong, okay?
No, you're wrong! Buddy, you're in over your head. That's why you're losing your job. And then what are you gonna do? Huh? I can write. What can you do?
But there are writers in the film industry. How about elsewhere? I ask that because the act of writing itself is not an easy one to cinematize. For the most part, it is a solitary, if not sedentary, activity. By contrast, it is far more interesting for an audience to watch a painter at the canvas. There you have movement and colour, or a musician practicing with an instrument. That gives you rhythm and melody. What does a writer have except these rude noises? Which means that movies about writers spend more time away from the desk than they do stuck in the confines of the lonely garret. But not all writers retreat to that lofty tower. You have journalists. And that leads us to Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, Warren Beatty's Reds, Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous, Todd McCarthy's Spotlight, and perhaps the greatest movie about print journalism, Alan J. Pakula's All the President's Men. All those characters are in pursuit of the same thing, truth. So here, typing is a moral imperative. Well, unless you work for Rupert Murdoch, in which case, typing is really hacking. Which is to say that to other journalists, the keyboard is a power tool. Take Charles Foster Kane. Deep into Orson Welles' masterpiece, Kane fires his friend Jedediah Leland because Jedediah dared to write a scathing, if honest, review of Kane's wife, Susan Alexander's debut at the Chicago Opera House. Drunk, Leland slumps unconscious at his desk, and Kane continues the review himself.
Hello, Jedediah.
Hello, Charlie. I didn't know we were speaking.
Sure we're speaking, Jedediah. You're fired.
From this, we can see that the typewriter is no longer the medium of conveying the news, but rather a vehicle of personal invective. Such a tone was continued in Otto Preminger's classic noir, Laura, where Waldo Leidecker also uses the typewriter to give his readers his biting and corrosive wit. Only this time, typing on his Remington Noiseless Portable from the very sober comfort of his bathtub.
I never liked the man. He was so obviously conscious of looking more like an athlete than an artist. I sat up the rest of the night writing a column about him. I demolished his affectations, exposed his camouflaged imitations of better painters, ridiculed his theories. I did it for her, knowing Jacoby was unworthy of her. It was a masterpiece, because it was a labor of love.
The nastiness doesn't end there. In Neil Jordan's masterful adaptation of Graham Greene's novel The End of the Affair, Morris Bendrix spends a great deal of time at his typewriter, writing up a confession, it appears, to no one in particular, until we gradually realize his words of anger are aimed at God.
This is a diary of hate.
In Curtis Hanson's adaptation of Michael Chabon's Wonder Boys, the young undergraduate James Lear has no problem undertaking and completing his first novel in the fall semester. Meanwhile, his tutor, Grady Tripp, seems to have lost all control over his own work, a follow-up to his immensely successful debut novel. But Tripp's new plot has proven so unwieldy, he's running into thousands of pages. Obviously, he is in desperate need of an editor.
So, how's the book?
It's fine, it's done. Well, basically, I got a little tinkering I still gotta do.
Great, great. I was hoping I could get a look at it sometime over the weekend. Do you think
it's
that'd be
a little
possible?
Tough. Yeah, I'm at a critical juncture right now. And
well, I thought you were just tinkering.
Well, I am, but I have a couple of details, little details I got to work on. And
I'm not going to pressure you. I just got off the plane, you know? I mean, I get pressure, you know? I get... You know what I mean?
An editor is what Paul Sheldon finds in Rob Reiner's adaptation of Stephen King's Misery. There, Sheldon is hostage to his own success when his number one fan, Annie Wilkes, holds him captive, demanding he write a sequel to a novel where he killed off his heroine.
You dirty bird. How could you? She can't be dead. Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Annie, in 1871, women often died in childbirth. But her spirit is the important thing, and Misery's spirit is still alive.
I don't want her dead! I want her! And you murdered her!
In the finale, Paul doesn't so much turn the tables on Annie as much as he turns his typewriter on her, thereby proving the typewriter is mightier than the sword. It's one thing to use your typewriter to defend yourself. What happens when you have to defend yourself against your own typewriter? This is what happens in David Cronenberg's effective adaptation of William H. Burroughs' allegedly unadaptable Naked Lunch. Over the course of the movie, William Lee uses several different models of typewriter, but encounters serious problems when he engages with a Remington Noiseless Portable because it starts to talk back to him.
Bill, could you do me a favor?
What?
I want you to type a few words into me. Words that I'll dictate to you.
Whoever would have thought that a typewriter could make you question your own sanity? Perhaps too much time at it can drive you over the edge. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy? In Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining, Jack Torrance descends into insanity when he volunteers to take care of the Overlook Hotel during its winter season. Torrance attempts to write a book on his Adler Universal, but the more he tries, the more he gets lost inside the maze of his own mind. Curiously, The Shining and Misery stories take place deep in snowbound mountains. Could the snow represent that terrifying vision of every writer, the blank page? As we can see, Paul Sheldon curses it. In Atonement, Robbie Turner types up a few naughty words as he declares his love for Cecilia Tallis. He starts out trying to type an apology on his Royal Number 10, but loses the run of himself. Unfortunately for Robbie, his note then falls into the wrong hands.
Brady!
And with its contents later used as evidence against him, he is sent away to prison. Evidently, a typewriter can be the source of embarrassing, if not self-incriminating secrets, rumours, gossip, and outright lies. Sid Hutchins' Hush Hush magazine provides the rumours and gossip in Curtis Hanson's superb adaptation of James Ellroy's classic crime novel, L.A. Confidential. More lies can be found in Antti Minghella's adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's thriller, The Talented Mr. Ripley. There, Tom Ripley uses Dickie Greenleaf's Olivetti Letter at 22 to compose Dickie's suicide note. So So the typewriter can be incriminating. And nowhere is that scene better than in Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's Oscar-winning masterpiece, The Lives of Others. In 1984, an East German playwright, Georg Dreyman, is under surveillance from Stasi agent Gerd Wiesler. Wiesler has wired Dreyman's apartment so that he can hear everything that happens. As he listens in, he types up his notes for his superiors. The resulting dossier is then used against Dreyman. Years later, after the collapse of the communist regime, Dreyman is granted access to the compiled dossier, and he writes about his experience. His resulting novel is then purchased by Wiesler, and in that way, the typewriter is transformed from a weapon of statewide tyranny into one of personal freedom. To finish off, permit me to focus on two films that do not revolve around typewriters, but contain two sharp sequences featuring the machine. Both directed by Steven Spielberg, Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List attest to the sanctity of the written word. After nearly traumatizing the audience with the landing sequence at the start of Saving Private Ryan, Spielberg cuts to a location far away from the front where the administrative part of the war is being fought. Here, a typing pool of secretaries is conveying the commands and orders of the generals, deciding what strategy will work best. These aren't just words they're typing. These are actions. And actions have consequences. The secretaries have to be quick, and their fingers need to be accurate, because one mistake could send a division in the wrong direction. Spielberg's camera tracks along the aisles between the tables, before settling on one woman who pauses before thoughtfully referencing another page she has already finished. She thumbs through the sheets, checking for details. Then another sheet, more details. Yet another sheet. Ashen, she gets up and walks silently into an office. She hands the document to her superior, and reading it, he heads off into another office where he hands it to his superior. This isn't an office dispatching orders. Here, the typewriter is a conveyor of death.
Dear Mr. Brian Boyd, no doubt by now you have received full information
about
the untimely death of your son.
No words of mine can ever relieve the
grief. Our outfit has felt his loss tremendously.
He was a fine soldier and he believed very strongly in what...
It's no secret anymore.
Spielberg presents something completely different in Schindler's List. The film begins shortly after the Nazi invasion of Poland, and immediately the Jewish population is ordered to register with the authorities.
It's a kudas.
Kudas.
It's a...
Zucker Helena.
Zucker Helena.
Their names are taken, lists are compiled, and the engine of the Holocaust starts up. As the cloud of extermination descends across European Jewry, Oskar Schindler's conscience is awoken, and he begins compiling his own list. This time to save those he can.
Older Pfefferberg, Miller Pfefferberg, and Steger, Powell Steger.
Doctor.
And by bookending the story with these actions, Spielberg shows us that the written word can be both lethal and liberating.
The list is an absolute good. The list is life. All around its margins lies the gulf.